Memorial Day is a holiday intended to honor and remember all who have died while serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. Last year on Memorial Day weekend, I preached a sermon titled, Becoming a Congregation Where All Bodies Count, challenging us to consider the ways we remember war in conversation with our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I invited us to reflect on the ways we need to remember the full consequences of war, which includes the fallen soldiers and the lost life on all sides, including civilian casualties. And recent headlines this past week about our broken veterans' healthcare system have served as the most recent tragic reminder that the aftermath and the responsibilities for declaring and enacting war continues long after the last shot is fired. For this Memorial Day, I'd like to invite us to reflect from a different angle on how we are invited to remember our war dead. And given our geographical proximity to Washington, D.C., I want to consider how we're invited to remember the effects of war in such different ways by various monuments on our National Mall in D.C. If I had my druthers, I would get us all on a big bus and take us down to the mall in D.C., though it's probably pretty crowded this morning. But I know most of you, has anyone not been to the mall? I wouldn't think so. Okay, so good. Because if you haven't, you need to go tomorrow. But I want to invite you. T.S. Eliot has a poem that he ends by saying, to go home after a long time is to experience that place again as if for the first time. So that's part of what I want you to do. The mall can become really familiar to us. So I want to invite you to experience it as if for the first time. And I want to focus on the four different ways in particular that we're invited to remember the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and the World War II Memorial. First, and I invite you to begin by remembering the various times, occasions, and reasons why you have visited our National Mall, as well as the various different circumstances in which you have visited those four spots in particular that I just mentioned, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and the newest of the four, the World War II Memorial. Can you picture yourself in turn standing in front of, around, and inside of each of those four monuments? I've heard it said that the difference between a tourist and a pilgrim is that a tourist passes through a place, but a pilgrim allows the place to pass through them. Begin to consider the different ways that you perhaps have experienced the monuments on the National Mall as a tourist, taking pictures, or as a commuter, just trying to get through the traffic, or as an exerciser, just passing through a beautiful spot. But perhaps other times as more of a pilgrim or an activist, going to one of these sacred sites within the landscape of our American civil religion. And it's significant to consider that the National Mall as we know it today is quite recent in terms of our nation's history. The Washington Monument was not completed until 1885, 2 decades after the end of the Civil War and almost a century after the death of our first president. And historian Kirk Savage, in his important 2009 book, Monument Wars, about the history of how our mall came to be, notes that at the time in the late 19th century, the National Mall was almost nothing like we know it today. Back then, the mall was a series of leisure zones, offering meandering walks amid well-tended gardens and groves, fringed by working operations such as railroad stations, greenhouses, arboretums, and even brothels. The clear-cutting that created the sacred space for the mall as we know it today did not happen until the first third of the 20th century, from 1904 to 1935. And from our perspective in the early 21st century, the mall's basic shape can really seem timeless, as if it has always been that way, when in fact it's been that way for a very short period of time in the grand scheme of things. Kirk writes that even as late as the 1920s, when huge memorials to Ulysses S. Grant and Abraham Lincoln were finished at either end of the mall's east-west axis, the space in between remained filled with flower gardens and old shade trees and curvilinear patterns that lasted until the mid-1930s. My favorite monument, that of our Unitarian forebear Thomas Jefferson, was not completed until 1943. Turning to the first of our four focal monuments, I invite you to imagine yourself standing before the Washington Monument. Can you see it in your mind's eye? And I don't intend to be disrespectful, but if you take a metaphorical step back, one question that might come to mind about this towering blank white obelisk is what exactly it has to do with George Washington. The land on which it is built does not have any special significance to Washington's life or death, and you can probably guess what Freud or Jung would say about it. That archetypally speaking, it is no coincidence that our young nation chose to commemorate its first president, the general that led us to victory in the War of Independence, with a giant phallic symbol. But I don't want to dwell on that for today. Of course, there are famous obelisks that the Washington Monument is copying in Egypt and in Rome. But when considering the Washington Monument in its late 19th century context, one would have expected the choice of a monument to have been a giant statue of George Washington. That's what you would have guessed. Or at least to have some famous quotations from our great general and our first president. Instead, the Washington Monument has no images, no ornament, no words of any kind, except for a very tiny inscription that almost no one has ever seen that credits the builders. It's on a 9-inch tall aluminum apex, 555 feet above the ground. The choice seems odd when you stop to think about it, and indeed the design could have been otherwise. Dozens of ideas and detailed designs were proposed, everything from a triumphal arch to a neo-Aztec tower. And even after the Washington Monument was completed, some critics went so far as to propose designs for, okay, we've got this thing, I hate it, now what can we do with it? That they begin to see it as a base around which something else might be built, a more elaborate structure. And we have a few different pictures, but one that was taken pretty seriously was to build a richly ornate Italian-style Gothic bell tower around the Washington Monument, using it as the base. Nevertheless, the final design as it stands is impressive. At 555 feet, it's taller than the Egyptian pyramids, and one reading of its meaning is that it honors Washington's memory through being a skyscraper monument in the late 19th century, testimony to that time's engineering skill and industrial power. It's radically out of scale with the picturesque landscape below, and it is aesthetically jarring. As you're kind of walking through the mall, everything's kind of level, and then you see the Washington Monument. And although we know now that its height was topped 5 years later by the Eiffel Tower, which is 900 feet higher, the Washington Monument remains the tallest unreinforced masonry structure in the world. Regarding the meaning of the giant obelisk, our transcendentalist forebear Walt Whitman wrote a poem, Washington's Monument, February 1885. The first line of that poem protests the design. Whitman writes, "Ah, not this marble, dead and cold." That was his way of beginning to protest the failure in his eyes of this monument to capture what he saw as the essential elements of Washington's character. In Whitman's words, courage, alertness, patience, faith, the same even in defeat, defeated not the same. Whitman concludes that in regard to President Washington, wherever freedom, poised by toleration, swayed by law, stands, that is thy true monument. But as you picture the Washington Monument in your mind, the first main point for this morning is that this towering blank white obelisk 555 feet into the air that we know only through tradition to call the Washington Monument, otherwise that would not be obvious, reminds us to remember the life of George Washington when we see it. Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, one of our founding fathers, and first president of our nation. But there's no mention of soldiers or the civilians that died under Washington's leadership and made his achievements possible. No monument would name an ordinary soldier until the first World War I monument in 1924, and that just named one regiment. Let us turn now in our mind's eye to the Lincoln Memorial. If you're particularly familiar with the mall, perhaps you can imagine yourself first with your back to the Lincoln Memorial, looking out over the reflecting pool to the Washington Monument in the distance. And then picture yourself turning 180 degrees to face the Lincoln Memorial, that image so familiar to us from the back of every penny, or most pennies. I don't want to take it up with the coin collectors later. And just as we went ahead and named the elephant in the room about the Washington Monument and that archetypally speaking it's a phallic symbol, we should also name the obvious that the Lincoln Memorial is clearly a neoclassical Greco-Roman temple, with Lincoln divinized at the center as the martyred hero of the Civil War who paid with his life. Indeed, the giant letters above the giant seated Lincoln, you may recall, say, "In this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever." And as with the Washington Monument, there is no significance to this location, to Lincoln's life or death. The site of the Lincoln Memorial did not even exist in Lincoln's lifetime. It sits on mud dredged up from the Potomac River bottom in the late 19th century by the Army Corps of Engineers. But the Lincoln Memorial has become a sacred space in our nation's civil religion. And unlike the stark blankness of the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial commands us to pay attention to two seminal speeches carved into the wall of that neoclassical Greco-Roman temple in 5-inch high, all capital letters. And the earliest, the Gettysburg Address, does explicitly remind us to remember the sacrifice of those Civil War soldiers. In President Lincoln's words, "We have come to dedicate a portion of that field on Gettysburg as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, they have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to dedicate here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us and that still remains before us. That from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of their devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that this government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth." The irony, of course, is that the larger-than-life carving of that speech, the Gettysburg Address, into a national monument, has meant what Lincoln could not have known at the time, that the world has long remembered what was said that day, but those words, importantly, and in the Lincoln Memorial, point beyond themselves to remind us to also remember not only Lincoln, the great leader, but also the sacrifices of lives made in the Revolutionary War and then in the Civil War for freedom, for equality, and for democracy, that government of, by, and for the people. And speaking of both unintended consequences and democracy in regard to the Lincoln Memorial, it's also worth noting that the mall's designers thought that they had created a vast space that would be for national unity, in which any expression of political or social differences would be naturally out of place. But as we know from the Civil Rights Movement, to the Vietnam protest, to the Million Man March, the Promise Keepers, John Stewart's Rally for Sanity, the mall has become the nation's premier setting of political assembly and protest. And I know that some of you likely have vivid memories of being swept up amidst the teeming masses in that stretch of the mall that runs from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument or from the Washington Monument to the Capitol. But I want to invite you now to recall a very different experience than the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Memorial or those political protests, and that is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. The giant scale and the vast open spaces around the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial make them a tourist magnet and ripe for political protest. But the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is almost the exact opposite. Instead of towering, white, majestic stone, we find an intimate setting built of dark, reflective stone. partially sunken below ground. Instead of 5-inch-high lettering of the Lincoln Memorial that commands you to stand at a distance and take in those majestic words, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the letters are 5/8 of an inch high. And they invite you and demand that you move close, close enough to see your reflection in that polished granite, and to trace your hand over those names of lost lives. Some relatives of the dead have said that they feel the presence of their lost loved ones much more strongly at Lynn's Wall than at the actual grave. Jung would say that the architecture of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the dark, reflective, interactive, intimate, below ground level, is a trigger inviting unconscious, repressed feelings about the war to emerge, to be confronted, and hopefully to begin to be integrated and healed. And in contrast to the Washington Monument, which invites us for the most part to remember only that great leader, President Washington, General Washington, or the Lincoln Memorial, which in the words of the Gettysburg Address invites us to remember the war dead generally. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial was the first and still the only war memorial in our capital that claims to include all the names of all U.S. dead in that war. There is nothing to identify them as heroes who have fought to uphold national and cultural ideals. We're just instead as pilgrims to that monument confronted with the simple, stark reality of war's high cost in human life. The paradigm shift is similar to the difference of reading history that is often told, focusing only on the leaders, in contrast to Howard Zinn's powerful book, The People's History of the United States. I encourage you to read it if you haven't, which tells America's story from the point of view and in the words of America's women, factory workers, African Americans, Native Americans, working poor, and immigrant laborers. And there are unfortunately tragic gaps even in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Only those U.S. soldiers who died from hostilities or accidents in the combat zone have their names engraved on the wall. Soldiers who died from exposure to Agent Orange or from suicide do not. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial is so different that it's really surprising in some ways that it ever got built. And it's fascinating to note that with the World War II Memorial, we get what some have seen as extreme overcompensation for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial ever getting built. In contrast to the Washington Monument, which lacks any inscription, even of the first president's name, the World War II Memorial has at its entrance, you may have noticed, a prominent inscription of the then-sitting president, George W. Bush's name, more conspicuous than on any previous monument on the National Mall. Virtually begging us to connect his war on terror and America's mid-20th century war against fascism. In the words of the historian Savage, the World War II Memorial is a rejoinder primarily to Lynn's Vietnam Veterans Memorial. White granite instead of black, plaza instead of park, loud instead of hushed, overflowing with words and images instead of stripped down and minimalist. Whereas the Vietnam Veterans Memorial lists the names of the dead, the World War II Memorial lists the names and places of battle. Although both memorials feature walls below grade that honor the war's dead, the World War II Wall of Freedom, which with a field of more than 4,000 gold stars, each one representing 100 dead, is inaccessible. So you can't touch the names like you do on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And it's behind a semicircular pool out of reach. Personal offerings still a vital part of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. There's been some fascinating documentaries of what's been left at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. They're impossible at the Wall of Stars for World War II veterans and discouraged elsewhere at the monument. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial avoided rendering final judgment on the war. The World War II Memorial splashes its message of righteous force and moral triumph from one end of the space to the other. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial suggested the limits of American military power. The World War II Memorial nostalgically celebrates the nation's military supremacy. The World War II Memorial is decidedly not a psychological space, not a space for reflection and reckoning. The roar of the fountain fills the space, and inscriptions trumpet their message of determination and rectitude. There is, of course, much more to be said about the other monuments on the Mall, as well as the events in our nation's history that we have not memorialized, as well as the new 9/11 Memorial in New York City. For now, on this Memorial Day weekend, I invite you to consider planning a pilgrimage sometime in the next few months to the National Mall. Try to see that place again as if for the first time. Take what I've said into consideration, but also consider what is the meaning for you and for your family. Experiment with what it feels like to see them afresh. And don't just pass through the place as a tourist. Allow the place to pass through you. But don't stop there. Take a step back at each point and consider, how are these monuments inviting me individually and us collectively as a nation to remember our history, to remember our leaders and our wars, as well as how you and we perhaps want and need to remember our nation's history in ways that are different than the monuments sometimes allow. I'll conclude with this Memorial Day meditation from the late William Sloan Coffin, former minister of the historic Riverside Church in New York City. He writes, "Grant that they may not have died in vain. May we draw new vigor from past tragedy. Buttress our instincts for peace that have been sorely beleaguered of late. Save us from justifications invented to make us look noble, grand, and righteous, and from blanket solutions to messy, detailed problems. Give us vision to see that those nations that gave the most to their generals and the least to their poor fall. Most of all, give us vision to see that the world is now too dangerous for anything but truth and too small for anything but love."